This is the Relics Audio Hour.
Hello, and welcome back to the second edition of the Relics Audio Hour. I'm your host, Jesse Lauder. So a new tradition has sprung in the Relics world as we host our live music conference at the Brooklyn Bowl in early May. I could regale you about this very special event, but I'm just going to let Relics' editor-in-chief, Dean Budnick, do the honors.
Thanks, Jesse. This episode of the Relics Audio Hour revisits the Relics Live Music Conference from earlier this year. The conference debuted in 2017 at Brooklyn Bowl, where the highlight was David Frick's keynote conversation with Ron Delsner and Peter Shapiro. Frick is a Relics contributor who wrote a notable Trey Anastasio cover story that looked back at his collaboration with the core four members of the Grateful Dead at Fare Thee Well. You can find a copy, along with other back issues, Relics merch, and the like, at relicsmarketplace.com. In 2018, the Relics Live Music Conference expanded to 2 days, with panels on festivals, agents, live streaming, sponsorships, entrepreneurs, and much more. Check out a photo gallery and recap in the July-August issue of Relics and learn about the RLMC at relicsmusicconference.com. I also wish to tip my cap to Bradley Tucker, whose idea sparked the conference and who explores the music industry in each issue of Relics through our Behind the Scenes section. Speaking of Relics, you can learn about the magazine and subscribe, please do, at relics.com. While you're there, you can also sign up to receive our monthly newsletter, as well as the Relics Daily 7, which compiles the best of relics.com and jambands.com and delivers it to your inbox.
Thanks, Dean. So this year's conference featured a very special fireside chat between one of rock's all-time great producers and one of its all-time great critics, Don Was and David Frick. Frick broached a handful of topics with Was, from his studio work with the Rolling Stones and Greg Allman to his more recent efforts in concert production, showcasing the diversity of Was's resume. As the head of the legendary record label Blue Note Records, as well as a musician in his own right, Was has a unique perspective on the future of the music industry. So here in all of its glory is the complete conversation between Don Was and David Frick, live from the Brooklyn Bowl.
Thank you very much for being here, for joining us, and thank you, Don, for agreeing to do. He's getting comfortable, man. He's lost the shoes, bare feet, he's on the couch. Everybody's comfy. Just by way of some little extra introduction, obviously, Don, a son of Detroit, co-founder of Was Not Was with David Was, the avant-rock and dance party band, producer, president of Blue Note Records. You're also the curator of The Sound of Vinyl, kind of a vinyl release project that you've actually working with Henry Rollins, which is kind of an interesting connection. And, musician, songwriter, executive, absolutely passionate and articulate music fan. My first question is, given that you've got basically three parallel gig tracks, you're a working musician, record producer, and you're the president of arguably the most important and enduring jazz record label in history, how do you organize your day?
Yeah, well, there's not really a disconnect. One time I read an interview with Frank Sinatra, and someone asked, he said, well, you're making a movie in L.A. in the day, and then you fly to Las Vegas, and you're doing the Rat Pack show at night, and then you're in the studio. How do you do it? And he said, well, just wherever you are, be there. Right? Be there 100%.
It's like the John Lennon thing, be here now.
Be here now, yes. Ram Dass.
Does the bare feet help make you feel comfortable?
Well, feeling comfortable is a... If you're not physically comfortable, you know, your day's got a limiter on it. You know, it's not going to be a good day if you're hurting or if your feet are hot. Yeah, no, you want to be comfortable and you want to have fun. But I'd say that I really don't see the things as being separate, if that makes sense. It's all part of a kind of singular mission. Can I read you something? That we got I just got this. It took me a second to find it. I'll try to talk through it. But we're doing a little. We do a Blue Note subscription box that comes out twice a year.
The Blue Note Review.
The Blue Note Review. Yes. And hang on. Someone just sent me. The current issue is about drummers, kind of. It's called Spirit and Time. And a writer put together a series of quotes that are really quite illuminating. And hold, let me just find this, because I was proofreading it earlier today. This is from Billy Hart, great, great jazz drummer.
Yeah.
And he says, rhythm has ancient and spiritual significance. Its purpose is to cause euphoria, and through that euphoria, physical healing occurs. It's a sensual thing. The purpose of rhythm is as old as humankind. Rhythm causes something that feels good. It's to create that euphoria for yourself and for anyone else who can hear it. The purpose of rhythm. That's what musicians do. And that's what everybody who's a spoke in the wheel of the music business is part of that effort to create that euphoria.
So for you, that hub of the wheel, the beat, everything comes out of that.
Everything comes out of that. I did this gig over the weekend with Ryan Adams. We played Exile on Main Street in its entirety in New Orleans. And it was cool. It was really cool. And Ryan, you know, he found his way into these songs so that we weren't just playing karaoke versions of them. We did a lot of stretching out. And he can really play guitar, man. I don't know if people know what a, because he's such a brilliant songwriter, I think, that maybe that overshadows his guitar playing. But we were stretching these things out. And there's something about what he was playing, and the drummer is a New Orleans guy named Terrence Higgins, who I played with a lot. So it was improvisational, not separate from like what the Dead would strive for or something like that, except that it was less, at least for me, it was less melodic and more locking in with the drums and following Ryan more rhythmically than melodically, right? And it was euphoric. And we probably got off stage around 12:30. I had a 5 a.m. flight to New York. And I had to wait 2 hours for the room to be ready. I was a mess, right? And I called a friend of mine on the phone. And I should have been a wreck, right? My friend said, wow, you sound great. You're all rested. And it was the euphoria of playing the gig. So I think that it's really important for people who are in the business part of it to remember what's at the core. Someone at the record company, doesn't have to be the president of the company, but someone at the record company better understand the real, not just the motivation, but the driving force behind the artists and behind the music. If you don't understand where it comes from, if you don't understand that feeling, you're going to have really awkward moments with artists.
as someone who is a musician and therefore really attuned to a musician's needs, insecurities, ambitions, and worries whether they can reach those ambitions, do you think that that puts you at an advantage in the business or at a disadvantage because you're actually working, you're swimming upstream. You're working against a current in which so much of the business is thinking in terms of quarterly reports, viral sensations, whoever, you know, is the new pop or hip hop thing that is getting all of the YouTube bites or whatever the technology is. Does that free you up, or does it make you feel maybe sometimes more isolated in your quest?
Oh, I think it's an extreme advantage to not be tuned into that stuff. Now, I say that being the president of Blue Note Records and not a label that's required to deliver along those lines. There would be no way that you could have some kind of viral sensation recording for Blue Note. That just doesn't, that goes against, you know, there's actually Jim Carosman, who's here, who's the heart and soul of Blue Note Records, worked there longer than, he's way younger than me, but he's worked there like way longer than anybody else. When I first took the gig, he showed me like a kind of manifesto that Alfred Lion and his buddies who founded the company had written. And it really, in short, it dedicated the label to the pursuit of authentic music and to providing, you know, unrelenting artistic freedom, basically, for, uncompromising freedom, I think is the wording. So it's easier for me to say that, you know, but just that kind of stuff has no place there. I will say this: if you look at our catalog, which is, as you mentioned, is formidable, and if you're just looking at it financially, it's a considerable earner every year. These are records that have stood test of time, that have been absolutely impervious to fashion. I'm sure when they were made, in fact, I know when they were made. I got to meet Rudy Van Gelder, who, and went out to his studio and talked to him shortly after taking the job there. And I said, all right, so when you were recording Love Supreme, which isn't a Blue Note record, but I said, when you were recording Love Supreme, did you know that? He said, absolutely not. It was just another day in the studio, and it was, he knew it was good, but he didn't know that people were still going to be asking him about it 60 years later. So I think there's a lot to be said. Well, there's a lot to be said for approaching music from a place of integrity and understanding what Billy Hart was talking about. There's a lot to be said for that as a good business plan. And
that is still a viable business model.
It's working for us.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about this Ryan Adams event, Exile on Bourbon Street, in which you covered the entire Exile on Main Street record. As the musical director for a production like that, how do you go about, and you did The Last Waltz a few years ago, which is how you ended up working with Warren Haynes and Government Mule on their last record. Yep. And you did the Beatles thing on television, with the anniversary of them coming to America. Mm-hmm. How do you go about pulling musicians together that you feel are going to be on common ground and yet not simply be the same? Because part of the band that you had in New Orleans was John Medeski and Cyril Neville. And then somebody like Ryan, who, like, how do you get Ryan to do anything? This is a guy who often doesn't know his own mind. And I love him for that, but still.
Well, you got him to do this. I don't know. I have a different view of him. I played with him live a lot. I've recorded with him, and I'm the president of his record company too. And he does a whole lot. I mean, he's probably the most prolific songwriter I've ever encountered, and not just prolific, but with such incredible quality maintained throughout. So with Ryan, it's a function of of narrowing things down, not getting him to do stuff. I called him up and ran the idea by him, and we talked about not wanting to do a karaoke version of Exile on Main Street, how you had to somehow capture the spirit of it, but to do that, you had to inhabit the songs. So he had to treat those songs as if he'd written them, and then Stanislavski them, you know, like become the speaker and find an emotional connection to each thing. And in some cases, that required changing the songs dramatically. He turned Happy into like a kind of country shuffle. He turned Rip Disjoint, we did, as more like Peggy Sue. Sweet Virginia was like a kind of 80s ballad. It was really good. But he was Ryan throughout. And once he felt confident that he could actually do that, then, yeah, no, it wasn't difficult to put it together.
Have you ever tried to convince the Stones to do something like that? They only just covered Sticky Fingers 2 years ago.
Yeah, I know. I don't remember.
That's not a question you feel safe asking?
No, we talk about everything. It's only in the last few years that I got a whole lot of memories about those records. That's what we talk about.
Well, it's interesting about doing something like Exile that way, because one of the first times I met you was in 1995 in Amsterdam at the Paradiso.
Yes.
When the Stones were doing Stripped.
Stripped, yeah.
And one of the things that you managed to do, and you mentioned this to me, was that you had actually convinced them to perform Shine a Light from Exile for the first time ever. How did you actually get them to do that? Because Mick is notoriously not nostalgic. And Keith really has a very purist sense of what he thinks the band should sound like live. And that song is really one that sort of fits in that bridge somewhere.
Well, you, I wish I had your memory, man, because I really don't know. I mean, I don't remember any real resistance to it. The phenomenon you're talking about of Mick not wanting to look back and be in the present moment and reconciling that with a really glorious musical history. That's an ongoing discussion.
How do you sort of, when you work with them, how do you, in a way, you sort of not, you don't have to navigate between Mick and Keith's views of the band, because in many ways those views are actually parallel, even though they can be very different. Yeah. But do you find that sometimes you are kind of the bridge for them to communicate with each other about how to move forward? Like, they've been working on, I guess, a studio record for 2 or 3 years at this point.
Yeah.
I'm assuming there is progress.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, it's not done, but there's some really good things in there. My style of producing is to work with artists that I have tremendous respect for. And the fun of it is to try to figure out what they're hearing in their head and help them realize it. Everybody approaches producing records differently, but I always thought it was kind of unsavory to leave your producer's thumbprint on Mick Jagger's forehead or Bob Dylan's forehead, or really anybody's forehead, to be honest with you. I always liked being invisible and just helping the thing rise to the highest level it could. And I always considered a record to be a total success if before it was even released and subject to any commercial judgments, if the artist says, it's everything I was hoping for and more, then I'm thrilled. Then I feel like I did what I was hired to do. So it's not for me to tell Mick Jagger to, sound like Exile. You know, that's like, if a guy wants to do that, great. If he doesn't want to do that, what do you want to sound like? I respect you. Let me help you get to that. In some cases, that can be like asking, someone to, like asking you to take high school English over again. You know, he did that already. Would I love to hear a Stones album that sounded like Exile? Of course. But that's not my job.
When they were doing those sessions that suddenly became Blue and Lonesome, which is the really great blues album they put out in 2016, actually, when we were talking at Desert Trip, you mentioned that they were actually sort of stalled on a particular track, yeah. And they just went into, I think it was this Little Walter number.
Yeah, Blue and Lonesome, yeah.
And just... As if, and it was just natural. They knew how to do this strictly from muscle memory. Did it seem like they should just get an album done, or did they just keep doing it? Like, and as a producer, you're just watching this and going, I'm not getting this done, but God damn, I'd much rather have this.
Yeah, no, it was, look, I would say that in the back of everyone's mind over the last, I've worked with them like 26 years or something. There's always been this notion, oh yeah, we should do a blues album. But if you'd gone to the studio and suggested that, it never would have happened. It came about in a really organic way, which was just, I wasn't even getting hung up on a song so much as acclimating to a new studio and getting the headphones right and then trying to worry about what the chords were. So it's like, all right, let's get the room singing first and then we'll worry about the chords to the new songs. So Keith just said, let's play Blue and Lonesome. And it was really to have fun and alleviate any tension and nervousness that might have been in the studio. And it was just fucking awesome. Thankfully, the engineer pressed record. And we went in the room and heard it. And someone said, let's do another one. And by the end of the day, we had like 5 or 6 songs cut. Now, I was certainly aware that we were more than halfway. I'm sure everybody was. But it was like, when a guy's pitching a no-hitter in the dugout, no one says, wow, 3 more innings. And it's like you nobody mentions it, right? So we just said, yeah, we'll come back. Maybe we'll do some more blues. We'll have fun. So the next day we cut another 5, and Eric Clapton was working next door, and he came in, and his jaw dropped because he's a couple years younger than them, and he used to go see them when he was, when they were just starting out at a pub in Richmond. So it took him right back, and he said, give me a guitar. So Keith gave him one of his guitars, and he plugged in, and that was great. And then, like a third day, we did 1 or 2 more. And then we put it away. And we put it away for months. And went on and started some other songs. And then time was up. And we went home. And a couple months later, I did some rough mixes. And then when they came out to L.A., which was a couple months after that, I gave them all CDs. And no one really remembered playing all those songs or even recognized that it wasn't like an old record, because what we did was we just used the room mics. If you don't use the close-up mics, that's how you get a pristine sound. But if you want it to sound like an old record, just use 5 mics. So the drum sound was coming from this mic, a Shure SM58, and which was Mick's vocal mic. And if he punched any vocals, the drums would disappear.
You'd lose the ambience.
So no one could, it didn't sound like that room or anything. So it was really kind of happenstance, but it was a good example of, not overthinking things.
Well, thinking from the label executive side of your brain, what is the value commercially of, say, an album of new Stone songs or of Dylan or of any of these artists of this vintage in an era when a record by someone even of that stature is really, in some ways, only good for one 24-hour news cycle. Like, an event like that is gone the next day because of White House something, business this, tweets that, Jay-Z this. You know, how can the Stones or any, actually, this goes for any artist, but in a way, they're almost like the elephant in the room. How do you produce great art and something that lasts in a culture where nothing gets the chance to get on its feet and walk?
I don't know the answer to that.
I guess that's why everybody's here, is to find out, including him.
No, look, I think the important words in there are great album. Just making a new album is actually meaningless. There's truly no point to that. But doing something that's got a real emotional connection that comes from a real place and that impacts people, that's got tremendous value. And I think you just have to believe that there's always a place for great music. And whatever the delivery systems are, however you promote it and market it, that shit's going to change it. I mean, I've been running a record company 7 years. I can't believe how much it's changed in those 7 years. But if you just make great music and aim for that, you find a way to monetize it, whatever delivery systems come up in the future. But that, if you don't have that, it doesn't matter what delivery systems come up. You just got shit, right? I can cite examples. So I know it's of course, it's been 20 years now, but I think of like an album like Time Out of Mind, the Bob Dylan record, right? Yeah. Which is a great album, right? And even then, people were saying, oh, we just want to hear Blonde and Blonde. He doesn't have to do anything new. But that's a great fucking record.
Yeah.
And his great songwriting and his vocal delivery is so direct. And that was worth making. So I don't mean to belittle your question. It's a really good question. But I don't know the answers to it. And if I knew it now, it's going to change in 6 months anyway. So the one thing that's constant is good music is important to the culture. And it's got an enduring shelf life. And you just have to use that as your model.
Well, when you do a show, and I was thinking about this, unfortunately, I didn't get to see the Ryan Adams show because I was up here. But in doing essentially repertoire productions, like you've done The Last Waltz, and Hal Wilner's doing Bob Dylan's 1963 Town Hall concert at Town Hall on May 24th, these kind of productions clearly celebrate legacy, they celebrate repertoire, they celebrate bedrock contributions to the literature and music of the country. But when we're focused on repertoire like that, does it make you wonder, where are the new classics going to come from so that someone can do repertoire of this era in 10 or 20 years? And jazz musicians have been through this forever because they still work with Sin Pan Alley. Mm-hmm. They still work with the Gershwins and Monk and Miles. But they're looking for new avenues when Brad Meldow does Radiohead or Nick Drake or the Bjorkestra, which is a group that out of New York that does Bjork, solely Bjork. Yeah. Like, how do you find repertoire that's going to last now?
No, it's a good question. When we did The Last Waltz, it started as a kind of tribute show. And those tribute shows, they can often be ephemeral. They're fun. It's fun to see all these people on one stage. But truth is, people are reading the lyrics off a teleprompter sometimes. And it's superficial stuff. But sometimes it goes really deep. And The Last Waltz show that we did, we were like really taken aback by the audience reaction to it. And then we realized that that those songs are like burned into the zeitgeist, and they really mean a whole lot to a generation, a couple generations of listeners.
Is it also that they can stand up to interpretation, that they don't have to exist just in that one body?
Yeah, they're great songs. But also, people don't get to, you know, Robbie's not out playing them. Garth Hudson did the tour with us, and so he was playing. But no one's out playing that repertoire, so you can't go out and hear a night of band songs the way you can if you go see Brian Wilson or McCartney or the Stones. Or, you know, they'll play all the songs you love. So people were starved to hear these songs. And when we took it out on tour, same reaction every night. In fact, I'll tell you the truth. I was located right behind Warren's amp, and it was really loud. And so, and everything was loud. On the one day, I measured the total volume on my spot. And it was like 108 dB. And it's starting to, I don't like to use in-ear monitors, and it was starting to hurt. And one night, I don't remember what city we're in, but I was watching, when we got to I Shall Be Released, it was every night, like people are swaying, and it looked like church in the audience, and you see people crying in the front rows, and it's such a beautiful song anyway. And I thought, well, you know something, if I gotta lose my hearing, let it be for this. Because it was a transcendental experience to be connected to an audience like that and to get to play those kind of songs. Kid is 20, and I can't tell you that 30 years from now, playing back Migos songs isn't going to elicit the same reaction in him. It's just not going to elicit that reaction in me. So I think a lot of it has to do with the music that moves you emotionally when you're young, and you carry that with you always. So I'm not too quick to dismiss what young people are listening to today.
It wasn't really a question about dismissal, but more like how does that music get the chance to imprint? Because the conditions by which the band could imprint on FM radio or touring or in the press are much different than what people have to hold on to now.
Well, it's a question of whether people's listening patterns have changed so that they don't go back and listen to the same thing that they listened to 3 months ago. I suspect they do. I think that there's music that will endure from this period that will mean something to people who are young now.
One of the records that Blue Note is putting out, I think in June, on June 29th, and this is a really wonderful record. It's Charles Lloyd, the great saxophonist, with his band The Marvels, which includes Greg Leitz on steel guitar, Bill Frisell, Ruben Rogers, and Lucinda Williams, who sings five songs. Four of them are Lucinda songs. So Charles is essentially covering Lucinda Williams songs with the author. And when I interviewed Charles recently for Jazz Times, we were talking about how they had met at a couple of shows because they had Greg and Bill in common because they had both played with both of them. But one of the things Charles said was that when Lucinda's album Car Wheels on a Gravel Road came out, someone had hipped him to it, and he really, really stuck with it because it reminded him of the South. He's originally from Memphis, and so all of what she was singing about there really connected with him in a very profound way, like 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a project that you felt you had to sort of help bring closer together, or was it really just a natural thing? Because this is really an example of taking repertoire and an artist on both counts and giving them a new avenue forward.
Well, Charles is an artist who is, over an entire career, continually pushed the threshold of genre and and been absolutely unafraid to step outside the boundaries.
He was the first jazz artist to record at the Fillmore Auditorium in February 1967.
Exactly. Very good.
That's why they pay me the long green.
No, his band was kind of like he discovered Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, Ron McClure was the bass player, and that quartet was like a rock and roll band. And
they really were.
That was before Miles was like a rock and roll band. It was really mind blowing, and I was a fan at that time, and I bought those records when they were new, and I went to see that band live. And then suddenly he disappeared for a minute, and then he came back with a record called Moon Man, which you should listen to if you can find it. And if I could find out who owned it, we'd re-release it on Blue Note. And he had like the Beach Boys on it, and it's kind of a rock and roll record, but there's blowing. I mean,
it's much more spiritual. It's more vocal.
It's he's singing. Yeah, I mean, it's a really deep. There's a song called Sweet Juvenia. Maybe it's on Spotify or Apple Music. You should try to find it. Sweet Juvenia, Charles Lloyd. And it's try to define that. Now, I grew up in an era in a city where that kind of thing was held at a premium. The coolest thing I saw as a teenager was I went down to a little print shop where they used to do the underground newspaper in Detroit, the Fifth Estate, where they printed up. And it was really late one night, and guys from the MC5 were jamming with guys from Pharoah Saunders Band. It's another one where the memory is a little blurry. But
hard to forget that.
It's hard to forget the event. What I do remember is that I'd never heard anything like that before, or really subsequently. And I thought, that's something really good to strive for, you know, create something new. Well, in the 90s, I became friendly with Leon Russell, and I asked him, I asked him what the difference was between making records in the 60s and making records in the 90s. And he said, in the 60s, if you handed in your record and someone said, oh, that's really cool, it reminds me of whatever, you could... Those were fighting words, man. That was the worst insult you could lay on anybody. That in the 90s and now, if you can't go in and say, well, it's a cross between Katy Perry and War on Drugs, you're in trouble. You know, if you can't find some kind of precedent for marketing something exactly like it, you know, that's a real drag. That's a problem. What I love about this record that Charles made is I can't define it. I can tell you where the roots of it are, but it's music that didn't exist before they went in and cut it over those couple of days.
We have stared into the eyes of people. We have slowed down. It's shared with him in the face.
You grew up in Detroit, and obviously the setting there for music, you had the black industrial working class with jazz, blues, Motown, high energy rock, the Five, the Stooges, Bob Seger, who was a star there long before he was a star anywhere else.
Played in my high school.
And but what was the first, what was your like road to Damascus moment? Like the record that first hit you either on radio, seeing somebody on TV, on the Robin Seymour show.
Very good.
or the record that you bought that went like, okay, my mind is blown, my path is set.
I don't know if there's one moment. You know, obviously everyone, this is not a Detroit moment, but seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan galvanized a whole generation. I was born in 1952, which made me 12 when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. And there are an inordinate number of musicians that I know who are exactly my age. And my theory is that if you were 12 and you saw all these girls screaming for the Beatles, you thought, I'm going to be that.
Yeah.
And if you were younger than that, it didn't register. And if you were older than that, you probably had more sense than to devote your life to doing that, and maybe backed it up and went to law school or something like that. So that was an important moment. But I would say that probably seeing Mitch Ryder in the early 60s.
Mitch Ryder in the Detroit Wheels.
Mitch Ryder in the Detroit Wheels.
If you can't get enough for him, just search it out.
Yeah. He had a rock and roll band, but they played really deep soul music, and he's essentially a soul singer.
Yeah.
And he brought that together in a way that is, I think it's pretty revolutionary. And it's also extremely Detroit. It was a great time to grow up in the 60s. I'm not saying that there wasn't racism, that there was institutionalized racism in Detroit and everywhere at the time. And I'm not saying that everyone got along like a utopia, but you did have people, not just from the South, but all cultures from all over the world, people coming after World War II to Detroit to find work in the auto factories. Yeah. And they all brought their cultures with them, and they all merged together, and you could, after a while, there were generations of people who absorbed all these different things and created a certain sound. Now, there's also something really peculiar to Detroit, which I think is that it was a city where the entire economy was dependent upon one industry. So, for example, my parents were both teachers, but if auto sales were down, they'd lay off workers who would then move away to find jobs somewhere else. And so then teachers would get laid off, and barbers would get laid off, and waitresses would get laid off. So everybody was in the same boat, and everyone's fate was tied to the auto business. And as a result, there was really no point in putting on airs. You know, it's Detroit, the very real natural people. It's a city without pretension. And, you know, like I never saw a limousine as a kid. There was probably one at the airport, but why bother driving? Everyone knows that we're all in the same boat, kind of, right? I think John Lee Hooker is probably the best example of Detroit music. It's as raw and unpretentious as it gets, but also as soulful as it gets. And you can see that in Mitch Ryder. You can see that in the Stooges and the MC5. You can hear that in the Motown records. Even though they had a glossy presentation, at the core, you listen to the Funk Brothers, that was a very raw, wild sounding, innovative group of musicians who were doing something that did not exist. It could have only come from the provinces. It didn't come from the fashion centers, that kind of music.
And it's interesting because there was an openness there. Obviously, San Francisco, LA, New York, Austin, Texas, you know, they all had their openness and the way the culture was expanding. But the thing that was interesting about Detroit, it was kind of summed up in something. When I was interviewing George Clinton once, I was asking about the evolution of the parliaments, which were basically sharkskin suits, I want to testify, into Funkadelic, where George is dropping acid, he's walking around in a bedsheet, Gary Scheider's wearing a diaper. And he said that the thing that actually opened his eyes was going to the Grandy Ballroom, and this really gets to the whole live music experience and why it is still so important today. He would go to the Grandy Ballroom and see the MC5 and the Vanilla Fudge, and you go, why can't black people do this? And that was really, you look at Funkadelic, Maggot Brain, that's, he's slowing everything down to the speed of Vanilla Fudge.
Yeah, I agree. You know, they were called the Parliaments, and they played a sock hop at my junior high school in the gym.
Oh, man.
And they came around with a local DJ. That was That was how you got your record played. You did a sock hop, and he got paid $150, and you didn't get paid, but you lip-synced your record, and then he played it that night on the show. And they had all the moves of the Temptations, but they were dressed like hippies. And it was a racially mixed school, blew everybody's mind to see this. It was synchronous with Hendrix. It was not neither ahead nor behind him. It was just something like, what is this? And it was the coolest thing ever.
That reminds me, Patti Smith once told me a story when she was in high school. She had, I think it was like some sort of a high school dance at the Latin Casino in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, with the Isley Brothers. And she saw this really amazing guitar player with them and thought he was just the total business, and realized later it was Jimi Hendrix. So pretty she cool. got to see Jimi Hendrix with the Isley Brothers. I wish. Were these the kind of experiences, like seeing the Parliaments or the records you're hearing or seeing the Five, how can you look back on those experiences and how they made you not just want to be a musician, but formulate your idea of what kind of records you wanted to make yourself? Because when you started Was Not Was with David Was, you're using very literate, almost surrealism, combining that with funk and avant jazz. You had Wayne Kramer on those records, as well as Sweet Pea Atkinson, the Killing Rhythm Sections, who could all dance and you know, really make, almost play disco, but with a real vengeance. Did those formative experiences help you formulate what you wanted to do on records, or was that something that really had to come once you started playing?
Well, then, initially, it was just, we were just trying to portray the milieu we grew up in, man. You know, it was all, that was just a blend. It just sounded like our record collection. You know, I suppose in today's culture, DJs would do it and actually just, you know, blend the records together. But we just got, Marcus Belgrave, great trumpet player who was playing with Charles Mingus at the time. We had the percussionist from Funkadelic, and Wayne Kramer and the Sweet Peas that are singing soul music, and we were mashing it together with a dance groove running through it. But we were just trying to, and David's lyrics were, I think, really influenced. You know, we were, as teenagers, we were huge fans of the beat poetry, and there was just kind of that sensibility, maybe some Frank Zappa combined in there. So we were just trying to synthesize our roots and to turn it into something new. You did it to him, you're dead to him. And I'm next.
One of the things that I think in this day, streaming and technology, in many ways, they almost blur the difference of where music comes from, because everything is available in particular portals. You can go to Spotify and hear all of the things that we're talking about. You can go to Apple Music and hear all the things we're talking about. But when everything is available, how do you determine the character of where something comes from? You know, you can hear in the records that you work on and you've made and that are obviously an influence, you can hear the character of Detroit. But how do you know this now when, certainly when you go to Spotify, all you can get is the name of the artist and the song title? There is no context at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's a problem. There's a lot to be said for having all that music at your fingertips. And I certainly avail myself of streaming music constantly, you know, so I don't have a problem with it. But I do have a problem with, you know, not getting any background information. I think that'll get worked out over time. It's not that hard to add credits. Before I got the gig at Blue Note, I wrote some scathing piece for the Huffington Post, like taking Apple to task for not including liner notes. And I heard from them in no uncertain terms. But they said, well, it's the record companies. They need to, you know, it's not our responsibility to gather up the information if they give us the information. And there was some validity to that. It's quite a big job. Universal Music Group, of which Blue Note is a part of, has something called Studio Hub that like producers hate so much, and it requires that you give them every bit of information and log it into a computer system, but it then becomes metadata that'll be inseparable from that music. They can't start listing credits and liner notes till you provide that information. I think it'll all get worked out. I really do believe that. At Blue Note, we're trying to do some of the exact opposite things. That subscription box we talked about, that was an attempt to get back the feeling. I love vinyl so much, and I have my whole life. The reason I know about Blue Note Records is that the album covers were so great. And we used to, before we could even drive, my buddies and I, we'd hop on a bus in Detroit, and we'd ride across town just to see an album. Because if you remember, in those days, every record store was different. It was owned and operated, owner-operated, right? And so everyone had a different stock that reflected their taste, or at least their sense of what was going to sell. So if there was a Larry Young Unity album in the rack across town, we'd ride a bus for 45 minutes just to hold the thing and to read the liner notes and to see who was playing on it. And so I was thinking, well, how can we get that back? And of course, we do a lot of vinyl reissues, but even so, we came up with this box that would have new music in it, old, you know, reissues, but we also have like some of the Francis Wolfe photos in lithograph quality. There's a little magazine that's evolving as we go along, this part of it. There's a John Varvatos Blue Note scarf in the first box. There's a Ryan Adams designed a turntable mat that said jazz is not a crime that we included in the box. And the idea was to try to go in the opposite direction and give, you know, by having a magazine, and Jem Kurosman, in fact, writes really great liner notes for the anthology record. That's the foundation of it. We're trying to do that at Blue Note. I think having something that's physical and experiential and tactile is a really important part of feeling connected to the music.
Heartily agree. Actually, as someone who writes liner notes, I heartily agree. Well, one of the things as a working musician and a bass player, and also as a label executive, working with acts who clearly have to tour to help the records and the songs get out there, how do you see the health of live performance vis-a-vis what it costs now to get in to a live performance? The ticket price thing is certainly much different than what it costs to go to the Grandy Ballroom, and certainly things are going to change. But I actually buy tickets as well as getting them as a critic. And I went to see Patti Smith recently at the Beacon Theater, and this was a Tribeca film screening of her Horses movie, and she performed live as well. And I was like, I'd love to see Patti, I'm just going to go. I got a couple of tickets. They were $55 up in the upper balcony at the Beacon. I was fine with that until I got the total, which was $150, because there were about $45 of service charges added. Now, I understand the horse is out of the stable. You know, as soon as the Eagle started charging $100, it was all over. And we're all used to this at airlines. But How are artists who are not the Stones, not Dylan, not even in jazz terms, say Charles or Wayne Shorter, how are those artists supposed to deal with an economy where the pricing of getting into the shows can be prohibited to the point where people, where they might have said, I'm going out three nights a week, now they got to figure out whether they can do it once a month?
No, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I know that it's important for musicians to get out and play. You know, when I first took the gig, I went to my first marketing meeting, and I thought, this sounds like 1983. This sounds like when we first started making records. Everyone's saying the same shit, and the whole world's changed. So I said, we got to do it. We got to go viral and all this. There was a lot of wisdom in some of the old ways. Everything shouldn't be discarded. At least for our artists, I've still found nothing more significant in terms of bringing awareness to the music and the musicians and to building a career and building an audience than getting out and going on tour. And our job is to maximize those appearances. If we have an artist play in Minnesota, then we make sure that there's some coverage from a local paper, that there's some kind of local radio. We work with a company that specializes in local NPR stations, which are really important. And you go out there and you build a grassroots support system very similar to the way it was done 50 years ago. I think there's still tremendous wisdom in building a career that way, and I don't know of anything more effective, really.
I've got about six other pages here, but I'm out of time. Okay. But we do have Q&A, apparently. Okay. I just got the Q&A sign. So if I can't quite see with the glare, but if we can help people.
I did, yeah.
We got a
microphone?
Line.
Yeah, okay, good. Hi.
First of all, thanks for being here. It's really, really cool to hear you guys talk.
It's a pleasure,
just amazing.
Man. It's good fun.
It's really, really great.
Thanks. It's a very cool event.
So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about working with Greg Allman on his last record.
Oh, yeah.
It's just such a special thing. And,
yeah, you know. Thank you, man. Well, it was his last record, and he knew it was going to be his last record. And I knew it was going to be his last record. And it was really deep, man. I've never had an experience like that before. He was looking to tie up a lot of all the loose ends in his life, and I think make sense out of it for himself, and also for his fans, you know, to try to explain himself to people. And every song was chosen for a reason. And what was weird about it was that, despite the gravitas involved in such a task, we had a lot of fun. And he'd been hearing a sound in his head. I think you can hear him kind of hinting at it on the Laid Back album. And he was never quite able to get back to that. And he was going after something. He wanted to get this in his lifetime, and we achieved the sound he was hearing in his head.
Well, it's interesting because there's a very beautiful moment on that record where Jackson Browne sings with him, and it's not just a beautiful vocal moment, but it's a real coming together in his life, because he and Jackson were roommates in Los Angeles when Greg was in the Hourglass.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles with Dwayne.
Roommates might be... They crashed on the same floor.
Wow. I was putting it genteelly.
No, very nice. He and Jackson go way back, which is how he heard These Days early on. I think he recorded that before Jackson did even. And that was having Jackson come back. First of all, that song, Song for Adam, that always reminded... Greg had been wanting to cut it for 30 years or something. It always reminded him of his brother's death. And it was very heavy. It was the last song we cut. There was a lot of Duane Allman spirit surrounding the whole thing, including the choice to record at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, which Greg picked because that's where Duane went after their band, the Hourglass, broke up, and he kind of got his start there. Rick Hall gave them the back room to have the seminal rehearsals for what became the Allman Brothers Band. And you can see there are like Duane Allman master tapes that no one knows what's on them because they don't have the machines to play them anymore, but they're on the shelf and the thing. So Greg wanted, I think, to commune with Duane's spirit. I don't know any other way to put it. And he was kind of ubiquitous in that room. So we saved that song for last because it was heavy. And if you listen to it, when it gets to the end, he gets to the line where he sings, but it seems that he stopped singing in the middle of his song. And I think Greg was thinking about Duane, and he got all choked up, and he couldn't get out the next lines, and he never finished the verse. And all the vocals that are on that album were cut live in the room with the band playing live. And we just kind of assumed we'd go back and finish it. But his health took a real turn for the worse very shortly after we had the sessions. And he was never able to sing again. And so we asked Jackson Browne to come in. Greg wanted to put harmonies on it. He had a way of singing harmony. You can hear it on Laid Back. He sings harmony with himself, and it's a very signature, distinctive sound. But we asked Jackson to come in and sing on it. And so he did that in Los Angeles, and he sent it to Greg and myself. And he didn't replace the last two lines, which I just assumed he was going to figure out a way of it being his lyric and everything. But as we started talking about it, we said, it's kind of like in a funeral procession, the horse, the riderless horse. It's like, it applies. Greg stopped singing in the middle of his song. And we thought, all right, we're going to leave that. I get chills. It was super deep, man. You know, it's tough for me to play that album and not get emotionally overwrought. But it's his exit. He stopped singing in the middle of his song, and it's the last song on the album.
Still it seemed he stopped singing in the middle of his song.
It was an incredible experience. What I can tell you is that Greg was the living embodiment of everything you imagined in a rock and roll star. When he walked out, I had the privilege of being able to play live with him a lot. And he came out on stage with the swagger and the tattoos and the hair and the rings. And he was the shit, man. He was the real deal. And he could deliver. But he was also one of the sweetest guys I ever met. You know, if you just sat alone with him, he had a really good, kind heart, and he meant well always. And I'm glad you liked the record.
Do we have another one there?
Hi, I'm Becky from the Ardmore Music Hall, and my question is, what are a few acts that you're listening to right now that have you really excited, whether you've seen them live or a record coming out?
Current acts? There are two bands I'm trying to sign right now, and I'm not going to tell you who they are because we'll start off bidding more and it's going to get ugly.
Can you describe them?
They're for real. I'm not going to. No, when I sign them, I'll tell you.
You'll get back to us on that one.
But we're listening all the time. I do want you to know that. And I think that if you look at the current roster of Blue Note Records, you'll see that we try to respect the foundations of the music and where the music came from. This month we put out a beautiful record by Kenny Barron, who's just you know, one of the giants of jazz piano. Good. Thank you. But we also look, we also feel that one of the hallmarks of the label over the years, the thing that, that I think allows the music to endure, is that whoever was running the label and making the records at the time, they were always trying to push the threshold of music, whether that was Thelonious, recording Thelonious Monk in 1948, which was a radical and revolutionary action to take at that time for a record company, or signing Art Blakey and Horace Silver in the 50s, or Ornette and Cecil Taylor in the 60s. Herbie and Wayne were doing really radical stuff when they made their, they were 25 years old when they made those records for Blue Note in the 60s, but they still stand up today. So we're trying to keep it moving, and also to, I guess you could say, to respect the foundations, but push the threshold and reflect the times that we live in. So I think someone like Bryan Adams is right at home on the label. Roseanne Cash has an incredible record coming out in September. She's as fine a singer-songwriter as there is, I believe. And I thought her last album, she won like 3 Grammys for it. It did quite well for us. I thought that was like her masterpiece, and I really feel she's actually up the ante with this new album. But they're authentic, soulful artists, and I guess I'm rambling at this point. Okay, go.
I'm actually curious. I don't know how much you can get in this, but what kind of a contract do you have with Blue Note that allows you to produce records for other labels? Record labels tend to be a little more proprietary about this sort of thing.
Well, yeah, no, it's a good contract. I actually think it's quite prescient of Universal Music Group and Capitol Records to understand that I'm of more value to everybody if I'm out there playing music and making records, regardless of who it's for, you know.
But if somebody says, well, you got a meeting at 11 o'clock with A&R, and you go, I'm sorry, I'm producing Warren Haynes, I'll be back on Wednesday, how do you juggle that?
Well, I don't know how many of you work out of offices. You can actually get, I'd say, 3 times as much work done if you're not in the office. it's good to show up, let people know that what you're doing and everything, but I actually find it's more efficient. And all the artists I work with are cool. You know, there are going to be points in the day when the producer disappears and has to return some phone calls, and no one's ever had a problem with that. It's like I said, it's really not that much of a stretch. When I first got offered the gig, I didn't want a job. My whole life, I didn't want a job. All I wanted was to get through life without ever having a job. And I never thought of playing music or producing records as work, you know? But this was a real job, right? Dan McCarroll, a good buddy of mine, was running Capitol Records at the time, and he offered me the job. I didn't want it. But Blue Note was irresistible.
Yeah.
But I thought, all right, I'm going to have to learn how to read profit and loss statements, and I'm going to have to learn something about marketing and all this other stuff. And there's a finite number of active synapses in the brain, and you can reactivate dormant synapses through repetition, but at peril of closing down the ones you're not using. I thought, all right, I'm going to learn to read a profit and loss statement, but I'll never write a fucking song again. But I'm not that good a songwriter anyway. It's no great loss. I can read a profit and loss statement.
Do we have another one out here?
So just as a closing for both of you, what's an album that I need to listen to that I've never heard of?
Ooh. You ever heard Speak No Evil by Wayne Shorter? Is that a yes? Shit. All right, well, how do I know what you've heard, man?
Hey, it's a hip room. What can I say?
Show me a list of what you've been listening to. And Nice. Candace Springs is a great artist who's on Blue Note. Soul Eyes is her first album. Kareem Riggin has just produced a new album. It's coming out in September. That's really good. Thank you very much.
And I would add that the Charles Lloyd record is genuinely fantastic. Charles Lloyd and the Marvels with Lucinda Williams. It's called Vanished Gardens. It's a stunner. It really is. So that's my two cents.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. All right. See y'all. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. God was.
Thanks for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed this special chat with Don Was and David Frick. The Relics Audio Hour is produced by yours truly in association with the Osiris Podcast Network. For more info on Osiris, go to osirispod.com. Our theme music was composed and performed by Marco Benevento. Special thanks for this episode goes out to Jonathan Healy, Brian Stollery, and Brad Tucker. You are currently listening to the new Charles Lloyd and the Marvels album with Lucinda Williams, called Vanished Gardens. Available everywhere on Blue Note Records. Thanks again, and be sure to join us next time on the Relics Audio Hour.